DW, Living Planet, with Sam Baker.
Welcome to Living Planet. Today, we'll be hearing about our friends in the animal kingdom. According to the United Nations, 1 million animal and plant species are threatened with extinction, many within the coming decades. Species like the golden lancehead pit viper. But as one of my guests explains, animals aren't so different from us humans. Later, we'll hear from the famed primatologist and conservation advocate Jane Goodall. First up, though, what happens when an animal is introduced to a new area and then wreaks havoc on the local landscape? I see the furry critters known as nutria all the time near our offices here in Bonn, Germany. They kind of look like a beaver, but have a long, skinny tail like a rat's. They're not native here in Germany or in the U.S., but nutria were once a major source of fur in both countries. Now, they're just an invasive nuisance. Mara Laser has this report from the swamps of Louisiana in the U.S.
Pumpkin orange is probably the first biggest distinguishing thing that everyone notices right off the bat. So they have these really long, nasty orange, pumpkin orange-ish yellow teeth.
I'm talking with Nick Stevens about nutria, or swamp rats. Imagine a light brown rat the size of a cat with webbed feet and fur. Nick works with Southeastern University of Louisiana and maintains the nutria population in this swamp. We are about an hour north of New Orleans, walking on a one-foot-wide boardwalk that extends about 30 meters into the swamp water.
You see the claw marks on the boardwalk from where they get up? They sit up here and chill because it's, you know, they're out of the water. They can dry off and stuff.
Nick tells me this 800-acre swamp was actually turned into an open-water lake. Nutria, along with other factors, destroyed the trees and the thick top layer of vegetation. When he says he maintains the nutria population, he means he keeps their numbers as low as possible by hunting them. A few summers ago, the population here and across much of the state was dangerously high.
If nutria are present in a habitat like this, in large enough quantities, they will eat. And they will eat it to a point to where it cannot grow back. They've eaten those plants that hold the floating marsh together. So those little critters managed to cause a whole bunch of damage in a very short amount of time.
During this dangerously high nutria phase, one student who had Nick's nutria maintenance job shot 10,000 nutria in one summer. Bob Thomas, a biologist and professor at Tulane, knows some people will hear this type of killing and want to save the animals.
Well, look, anytime you're talking about taking an animal out of existence, there are going to be people who have an adverse reaction to that. And I respect those feelings and those emotions. I don't respect the decision because I see the actual damage that's going on.
Bob describes what's called an eat-out.
They would come out at night and literally overnight in an expansive area cut down all the vegetation and kill it to where it, in many places, it's never come back even today.
One unique problem about nutria eat-outs, however, is that they reproduce so rapidly. Nick describes exactly how quickly.
Every 6 weeks, they can have a litter, and the litter can be like up to 8 to 12. And they can get pregnant 12 hours after giving birth. They just produce.
And they aren't native to the area, so they don't have any natural predators. They were brought to the United States from South America in the 19th century by fur farmers. Their velvety underfur was profitable for fur farmers until the fur industry crashed. Then nutria numbers soared. This forced people here to come up with creative ways to control the population. The state created an incentive program for hunters to kill nutria. For each nutria tail you brought in, you would get $5. Chefs have attempted to feature the meat on their menus and encourage people to eat nutria. Pushback is strong, though. Many people are not super enthusiastic about eating a swamp rat.
They just eat vegetation, so they are a clean meat.
This is Liz LeCompte, a hunter in Lockport, Louisiana. We are driving in her Toyota pickup across her family's land. We are about an hour southwest of New Orleans, very close to the edge of Louisiana, where the land becomes Gulf water. Generations of her family hunted nutria for income. Some people sell the teeth as jewelry. A local SWAT team uses nutria as target practice at night. Others try to bring back the market's interest in their soft fur by making vests and hats with it. Lots of creative suggestions to stop the destruction that is impossible to miss.
Used to, you'd come over the Leeville Bridge, you'd see so much land right there. That was a lot of land and all. And now you cross the bridge, all you see is water, you know? You can see the land disappearing, you know, in a short period of time. The land's gone. No more land.
The Leeville Bridge is 8 miles long, one of the longest bridges in the world. That once was above Little Lakes is now above open water. Back on her family land, they had their own worries too.
Yeah, we knew it was a problem because on some of the levees, you know, you'd be on a levee with a tractor, you'd hit a big hole or like a little ditch con, and you know, you could tell the nutrias make a little trail. You could see where they come up and down and stuff. And we could tell that it was them that was eating it up.
The animals burrowing holes into the levees can be a big problem in this area. The levees are like man-made fences of land to try and protect the people from storms and flooding. They are so vulnerable to floods in this area. The few barriers they still have really need to be protected. I talked with Nick about nutria contributing to the adage in Louisiana that we lose a football field size of land every 15 minutes.
Now we've lost so much and we've lost all the fragile parts already that it's kind of slowed down a little bit. That now we're losing about a football field every hour. And that's not that we're doing better. It's that literally now we're starting to eat land that is people's homes and just swamp. It's not marsh anymore. We've lost the marsh. We've lost the barrier islands, the protection.
Nutria, unfortunately, are not the biggest or sole contributors to land loss in Louisiana. Dredging from the oil and gas industry has contributed significant destruction. Climate change brings more destructive storms. The construction of levees prevents soil deposition in marshes. The list of factors is not short. The fight to save Louisiana's land continues, but hopefully these watchful eyes and hands can prevent the nutria from completely feasting on the land until it disappears. For DW, I'm Mara Laser in Louisiana.
Back in 1960, at the age of 26, Jane Goodall ventured to Gombe Stream National Park in Tanzania to study chimpanzees. Her discoveries were groundbreaking. For instance, she found that like humans, chimps use tools. Her approach to fieldwork was revolutionary. She immersed herself in the chimps' daily lives and gave them names. Since then, Dr. Goodall has become a tireless advocate for conservation, in addition to being one of the world's best-known primatologists. In 1977, she founded the Jane Goodall Institute, which works around the world to protect wildlife and the environment, but also improves the lives of people in order to further conservation efforts. I recently got the chance to speak with Dr. Goodall over the phone from her home in the UK. As she travels the globe upwards of 300 days a year speaking about hope, I started out by asking what gives her hope for our planet.
Well, the hope is dependent on our taking action now. I mean, I don't think we've got forever to think things are going to come right unless we do something about it, because they're not. But my hope is the energy and commitment of young people now that they're beginning to understand the problems and we're empowering them to take action and listening to them. So that's probably my greatest reason for hope. But also, we have this incredible intellect, and we're beginning to use that to find ways that we can live in greater harmony with the planet, you know, to extract carbon dioxide from the air and find ways of living our lives so that we each leave a lighter ecological footprint. And then the next reason is the resilience of nature, so that we can completely destroy an environment and then give it time and perhaps some help. And once again, nature can return, maybe not quite the same. And animals on the very brink of extinction can be and have been given another chance. And then finally, there's the indomitable human spirit, the people who tackle what seems to be impossible and won't give up and inspire everybody around them. So those are my main reasons for hope. Now, that's the only reason I keep going. I meet amazing people and I see incredible projects.
Do you ever feel like giving up? Have you ever...
I don't feel like giving up. I sometimes feel I don't know how much longer I can go on, but not giving up while I can do something about it.
What would you say some of your biggest takeaways have been from working on conservation efforts over the years?
Well, I think some of the stories about the resilience of nature. I've just been in New Zealand, and some time ago I wrote a book called Hope for Animals and Their World. And in it was the story of the little black robin, about the size of our robin, but it's completely black, and it's not related, of course. And the hero of the story is Don Merton, who's sadly since died of cancer, but he studied them, and he noticed their numbers were dwindling. There were only, I think it was 12 birds left, so they caught them all, took them to an offshore island, went back in the spring, because it couldn't get there in the winter, it's too rough and rugged, and there were only 7 birds left. Mm. And of those 7, only one female, and she was mated, and they mate for life normally. She was mated to a male who turned out to be infertile. So she dumped her husband, picked one of the younger males, and they bonded, and they made a nest. And Don risked something which he wasn't sure would work, and so took a lot of courage, I think. He destroyed the nest and took out the 2 eggs, and gave the 2 eggs to hatch to a bird of similar size, quite common, a tomtit. And as he had prayed and hoped, they were called blue and yellow. Blue had a blue leg band, and yellow had a yellow one. So blue and yellow made another nest, and blue laid 2 more eggs. And he took those away and gave them to another pair of tomtits. And then he left them with their 3rd nest and their last 2 eggs. And then he realized, well, if I leave the babies who've just hatched with the tomtits, they won't know how to be black robins. So he took the 2 babies, little tiny babies, to Blue on her nest. And she accepted them. And she went on, you know, incubating her last 2 eggs. And then the next 2 were the tomtits hatched. So he took them back as well. And he said, Blue looked up at me as if to say, what next? And he said, it's all right, darling. We're going to help you. So he and the other biologists ran around helping Yellow to catch food to feed Blue and the growing family. And now there's over 500.
Wow. Amazing.
So, I mean, that's a beautiful story.
Yeah, definitely. What do you wish people knew more about animals?
That animals like us have feelings, that they have personalities, that they can feel happy or sad, that they can feel pain and fear and despair, and that they're so much more intelligent than we used to think. The way we treat them in the factory farms, the puppy mills, horrible training for circuses, keeping whales and dolphins in aquariums, all of these things we do are so, so appalling once you realize it's not just humans who have personalities, minds, and emotions.
With all of your work in conservation and studying chimps, what have animals taught you about humans?
That we've been so wretchedly arrogant, that we're part of the animal kingdom and not separated from it, that we have inherited a lot of aggressive tendencies, for example, but also altruistic ones, both of which we find in the chimp, but that with our intellect, we actually are capable of controlling our instincts, and we don't do a very good job of it.
You've inspired a lot of people around the world, especially women, female primatologists, scientists, women in all walks of life who have seen the risks you've taken in your work and the way you speak about your work as revolutionary. I was just wondering what women in your life have inspired you.
Well, my mother, my grandmother. I mean, when I began, you know, there weren't women doing anything like what I wanted to do. Not at all. There just weren't any.
What inspired you to get into the work that you did? What made you believe that you could do that work?
Well, I was 10 years old when I decided I would go to Africa, live with animals and write books about them. That was after reading Dr. Doolittle and Tarzan. And everybody laughed at me and said it would be impossible, except my mother, who said, if you really want this, you're going to have to work really hard, take advantage of every opportunity, but don't give up. That's what I've told young people, especially girls in disadvantaged communities. And I just wish Mom was alive to know how many people have said to me, thank you, Jane, you've taught me, because you did it, I can do it too.
Well, I have just one last question. If reincarnation is real, what creature would you like to come back as in the next life?
Well, I actually think if there is reincarnation, it will be giving us a second chance to do better. And I think I would come back as another human being. But if I had to be an animal, in the world today, it's hard to know, because animals are having such a tough time everywhere. I'd like to be a dog in a really good family that understands and loves dogs, because I think the dog-human relationship is wonderful. And it was my dog, Rusty, who taught me about animals when I was growing up.
Thank you so much, Dr. Goodall, for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
That was world-renowned conservationist and primatologist Jane Goodall. We'll have more from my interview with her on our website, dw.com/environment. Worldwide, 7,000 species suffer from wildlife trafficking. One of the species threatened with extinction is the pangolin. One of these shy, nocturnal creatures found in Africa and parts of Asia is poached every 5 minutes, according to estimates by the International Union for Conservation of Nature. Resembling an armored anteater, pangolins are ruthlessly hunted for their scales, which are highly sought after in countries like China and Vietnam. They are incorrectly considered to be a remedy for all kinds of ailments, from asthma to cancer. Most pangolin smugglers head to Asia via West Africa. But first, they must travel through Kenya. Linda Staude brings us this report from Nairobi, and it is presented by Sarah Steffen.
Asha, the sniffer dog, excitedly jumps up onto the luggage belt at Nairobi's Jomo Kenyatta International Airport. She darts around from suitcase to suitcase. The small black and white Springer Spaniel eagerly sniffs each piece of luggage in search of illegally smuggled goods, from rhino horns to pangolins. Dog handler Imali Kasawa from the Kenya Wildlife Service says the dogs must be continuously trained.
They are specialized in ivory and the pangolin. That's why I said we carry on continuous training. We have to test, is it okay with the sniffing pangolin? Is it okay with rhino horn? Is it okay with the ivory?
For years, Kenya has been a hub for smuggling ivory and rhino horn. And now the trade in pangolins is also on the rise, explains Frank Keisha, also from the Kenya Wildlife Service.
Pangolin now is booming. The sniffer team have done a great job in JKIA. From 2016 up to now, they have managed to recover and seize 1.8 tons of pangolin.
Pangolins look kind of like an armored anteater. They are the only mammal with huge protective keratin scales covering their skin, which resembles the surface of a pine cone or an artichoke. It's a perfect protection against predators in the wild. Two lions are on the hunt for a pangolin. But just like a domestic cat, the pangolin can move fast as lightning and curls up into a ball when threatened. like a hedgehog. The lions try in vain to crack the pangolin's shell using their sharp claws and teeth, but they just don't manage. The lions eventually give up and move on. But although pangolin scales might be the perfect kind of protection against other animals, it now has a different kind of predator to worry about, says Philip Muruti from the African Wildlife Foundation.
The pangolin is the most illegally traded African animal.
An estimated 100,000 pangolins are killed by poachers every year. Their scales are ground into a powder and used in Asian countries like China and Vietnam as a supposed cure for various ailments and diseases, ranging from arthritis to cancer. But the scales are made of a very common material also found on humans, rendering the so-called medicine essentially useless.
They're made of keratins. You can chew your fingernail. Then that is the product or the content being found in pangolin scale.
Pangolin meat is also served as a delicacy in some high-end restaurants, explains Frank Kesha. Right now, all 8 species of pangolin are on the International Union for Conservation of Nature's Red List of Threatened Species. There's a chance they might become extinct before most people have even heard of them. Even some locals from the older generation have never seen one, says Kesha.
Even we have somebody 70 years who have never came across a pangolin. So these are generation see pangolins only on TV.
A pangolin eats mainly ants and termites. It uses its giant curved claws to dig away at the hard earth until it reaches the insect's nest below. The pangolin then unfurls its long, narrow tongue, which measures an impressive 40 centimeters or almost 16 inches, and licks up its hard-to-reach meal. But its preference for being active at night means few people get the chance to see this kind of behavior in action, explains Paul Gatitu.
It's a nocturnal animal, so it's very active at night, and therefore it's very difficult to see it during the day. This is a very secretive animal. The occurrence, particularly in Kenya, is on the western side.
Mafia-esque organized smuggling syndicates, many of which are based in West Africa, mercilessly hunt for the pangolins. And the rarer they become, the higher the price superstitious customers in Asia are willing to pay. Philip Muruti thinks it's time for Africans to start fighting back against the trade.
The solution to African wildlife issues lies very much with Africans. I think it is very important to encourage our people to stop being middlemen, being the poachers. The motivation to poach for money is greed, and it should be stopped.
The illegal trade in wildlife of all kinds brings about $23 billion in revenue every year, or around 20 billion euros, and the risk is often quite low. Kenya is one of the few countries to have caught smugglers red-handed as they tried to leave the country and imposed hefty punishments. Back at the airport, Asha the dog suddenly sits down next to a green canvas backpack on the luggage belt. Inside are a few tiny scales, barely larger than a fingernail. Dog handler Imali Kasawa is proud.
When we are on the ground, nothing will pass.
But the smugglers are well aware of this too.
The rate of arresting and recovering 2015 and 2016, it was too high. Because in a month you could make more than 10 arrests. But up to now, you can finish even a month without getting something.
Unfortunately, this doesn't mean that fewer pangolins are being poached. Just last year in China, for example, an entire shipping container full of pangolin scales was confiscated. An estimated 20,000 pangolins were killed for that 13-ton haul. As poachers continue to find ways to evade authorities at transit hubs, Frank Kesha thinks protection methods for the pangolin need to be expanded beyond the airport.
If a smuggler being caught twice or thrice in the same airport, they have looked for other means of transporting rather than using the JKI. So we would like to see people protecting pangolin in the wilderness rather than caughting them in the airport.
Conservationists can only hope that the damage hasn't already been done and that the rare pangolins won't be lost forever.
That story was narrated by Sarah Steffen and reported by Linda Staude. Now, I don't know about you, but I am not a big fan of snakes. So the island of Caimada Grande off Brazil's coast, which is densely populated with poisonous snakes, is pretty much my worst nightmare. While people are strictly banned from this so-called Snake Island, this scary and mysterious place may just be a saving grace for one endangered species. From Brazil, Ivo Marushik sends this report, which is narrated by Ineke Mules.
The small island in the Atlantic Ocean is a restricted area. Only marines ever step foot on this rock every once in a while to change the batteries of the lighthouse beacon. Researchers also sometimes visit the island for study purposes. They film their encounters with the terrifying snakes for the rest of the world to see. Officially, the island is called Queimada Grande, which roughly translates to Big Burnt Island. But it's best known locally as Ilha das Cobras, or Snake Island. It's the only known home of the golden lancehead snake, a species of pit viper and one of the most dangerous serpents in the world. Unsurprisingly, this place is the stuff of nightmares. At least one snake is suspected to occupy every square meter of the island. One lighthouse keeper after another is rumoured to have succumbed to the deadly venom. Of course, a lot of these facts are probably exaggerated for the sake of a good story. But it's certainly true that the venom of the golden lancehead is more potent than their cousins on the mainland. Giuseppe Porto, the director of the biology museum at the Butantan Institute in Sao Paulo, explains.
The golden lanceheads on the island have a special, more toxic and aggressive type of venom that allows them to hunt birds because they are their main source of food. Meanwhile, the lancehead snakes on the mainland are designed to hunt and capture rodents.
There are no mammals on the entire island, which is located 33 kilometers off the coast. So the only prey available to the snakes is the unwitting migratory birds that use the island as a place to rest. And so the snake evolved as a means of survival, explains biologist Karina Kasparov-Vizos, also from the Butantan Institute, which is one of the leading institutes when it comes to snake poison.
The snakes that managed to capture the birds had a selective advantage. They then propagated among one another until a new species emerged. They could capture birds and climb trees.
The poison of the golden lancehead vipers found on the island is up to 5 times more potent than that of the lanceheads on the mainland. 2,000 to 3,000 of these snakes occupy a space of just 43 hectares, under half a square kilometre. This makes the island the densest snake-populated area in the world. But the golden lanceheads are endangered, probably due to inbreeding. There is an increasingly high rate of intersex snakes, individuals born with both male and female reproductive parts, many of which are sterile. The fact that very few people can step foot on the island today is not so much to protect humans from the snakes, but to protect the snakes from the humans.
That piece was presented by Ineke Mules with reporting from Ivo Marushik. And that brings us to the end of another edition of Living Planet. Our studio manager this week was Ileana Ghilarducci. Michael Springer was our studio technician. Irene Quill, Ineke Mules, and Sarah Steffen helped with production. And I'm Sam Baker. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with more environment stories from around the world.
Pedra é o fim do caminho, é o resto de toco, é um pouco sozinho, é um caco de vidro, é a vida, é o sol, é a noite, é a morte, é o laço, é o anzol, é peroba do cão,
é o nó da madeira,
canga, candeia,
é uma tita pereira,
é madeira de vento,
é um
mistério profundo,
é o queira ou não queira,
é o